for Black people in this country to try to have home here, to try to find home here in the sense of property that you own, within the sense of belonging. Home is where you belong. It's where you lay down roots. It's where the babies, if you're fortunate enough to have them, if they're blessed to come behind you, it's where they learn about their roots, right? And so what does it mean for home for so many of us in Black and brown communities, especially to have been a place that is constantly fragile and rarely ours?
Leaving the home of Bessie Smith, I began to think about the experience of the American dream for those who were brought to this country against their will and enslaved. Now, I've read the statistics, like you probably have. Centuries of the institution of slavery are clearly still felt today. White people live about 10 years longer than people of color. Black women are more than twice as likely to die during childbirth. 72% of white folks own their homes, while just 40% of Black folks do. And I know that numbers don't tell the whole story. I wonder what the data feels like from the inside. How does this myth of the American dream feel if the American dream was built on your back? This is Complexified, where religion and politics collide with real life. I'm your host, Amanda Henderson. Welcome to our third episode of Season 4, Dreaming America. To learn more about what it feels like to navigate this myth of the American dream from the experience of being Black in America, I reached out to my friend and colleague, Ben Sanders. Ben works for the city of Denver as the chief equity officer. He's a social ethicist, a theologian, a pastor, a change agent, and a dad. Ben grew up in Evanston, Illinois, just north of Chicago, where his grandmother moved during the Great Migration from the Jim Crow South to the industrial Midwest. Life wasn't always easy. I sat down with Ben at our studio at Iliff School of Theology on a warm morning in late August, and I asked Ben what he thinks of when he hears this phrase, American dream.
Thank you, Amanda. Pleasure to be here. I've been thinking about this topic of the American dream, and I continue to come back to my grandmother, which for me is a powerful place to begin reflecting on the American dream, because my grandmother is both a symbol for me of how much I know about myself and how little I know about myself and my family. So I'll start by saying that my grandmother was the first of my family to move up to Evanston, Illinois, just north of Chicago, where I grew up. And so this is where, for me, as is the case for many folks, especially many Black folks in this country, it's a little tricky to sort of piece together details. So I'm working on, with some other members of my family, piecing some things together right now. My grandmother was really the sort of core, the heartbeat of our family. She was the glue that held us together. When she passed away in late 2014, we lost some important glue. It was really one of those passages that marked not just a life, but a generation and a sort of way of being, not just for myself, but for my entire family. I mean, literally, everything that we would do as a family, we would do at my grandmother's house.
Yeah.
She never owned her house, but for the majority of my life, she lived at 1428 Florence Avenue in Evanston, Illinois, in a house that ended up being right across the street from a park, not far from my high school, and really kind of in the center of our small town, Evanston, Illinois. And that house became another kind of symbol, almost an extension of my grandmother, of again, this dream, because it was the place where we had family gatherings and family conversations and family arguments.
Yeah.
And it was also the place that was never ours. So when my grandmother passed, one of the most painful things about processing her passing as our family was that we started to move her belongings out of the rental property in which she'd lived for decades. And like that, something that had been ours something that had been our space, something that had been the place where we would gather and discuss and decide on some of the most important decisions of our lives, was no longer ours.
Growing up, my family didn't have a lot of money. And my mom had been taught by her father that at the first chance she got, she should buy real estate. So after scraping together enough money and applying for a VA loan thanks to military service, my parents bought their first home when I was 7 years old, a condominium where my dad was going to college. And they were able to officially get in the market. For Black folks in the United States, there was no chance to get in the market. Of course, for the first 100 years, Black people could be sold and bought as property. And after abolition, it took another 100 years before the Fair Housing Act of 1968 was addressed to pass redlining and rampant discrimination that kept Black folks from getting loans or living in certain neighborhoods. While improvements in home ownership were seen initially, today, home ownership among Blacks is actually lower than it was 10 years ago. I asked Ben what this felt like for his family in that moment, sitting in his grandmother's living room, and what it still means to them today.
That was a moment that I think we all kind of understood was happening, but we couldn't make sense of. And so between that and the fact that almost no one else in my family owns property or a home to this day, to this day, very few of my family members own their homes, own where they live. And there's a couple of points there, right? There's home ownership, but there's also the point of what it means for Black people in this country to try to have home here, to try to find home here in the sense of property that you own, but also just in the sense of belonging. Home
place
is where you belong.
And belonging, yeah,
it's where you lay down roots. It's where the babies, if you're fortunate enough to have them and they're blessed to come behind you, it's where they learn about their roots, right? Mm-hmm. And so what does it mean for home for so many of us in Black and brown communities, especially to have been a place that is constantly fragile and rarely ours in a sort of sustainable sense? So what that's meant for me personally, Amanda, is it's meant that it's been very important to me to strive for home ownership as a personal goal.
Yeah.
Some of this I know is me processing some of my own childhood trauma around poverty. We were homeless for stints of time when I was a kid. Of course, you didn't know you were homeless at the time, but if you're living on your aunt's sun porch because you have to, you know, with your siblings and all of your belongings, at the time it was we were just staying with auntie. In hindsight, I know that my mother was in a phase of life where she couldn't afford a home for us. Yeah. And oftentimes later in life, because again, I mean, kids rarely recognize all of what's going on, though I do think we catch parts of it in different ways, because I've seen what that costs. The kids who grow up in situations where you're constantly moving, we moved a ton when I was a kid, always in that same town of Evanston, Illinois. But boy, oh boy, we lived in a lot of different apartments. Mm-hmm. And so I had a hometown and maybe parts of town that felt more homey to me because we lived in, you know, similar areas often. But it has been very important to me to strive for a place that I could call home, that my family, that we can call our home. And I think this is especially true when I think about my kids, for them to have a place that they can call home.
Yeah.
I bought my first house when I lived in St. Louis, Missouri, and I was working as a seminary professor. We worked through a program that's designed to help folks who can't afford a down payment, but could probably afford a mortgage to get into a home. And the sense of pride and, dare I say, safety that I felt when we were inside of our own space is something that I valued. And now to watch our kids, our teenagers, and our 2-year-old move in space that is ours, in a sense that I never had as a child, it's something that I take great pride in. I started off talking about home and my grandmother's house, right? But for me, it is about that house. And because we had to move her stuff out, it is about her house as property. But all of that's already happening inside of a certain matrix where belonging and ownership are so tightly linked together that we sometimes forget that they're not the same thing.
This moment struck me as profound. Sometimes ownership and belonging are so tightly linked together, we forget they're not the same thing. How often is our sense of belonging tied to something we want to own, a house, a car, or a brand? How many advertisements tell us we have to have this or we have to have that to belong? We all need to feel like we belong. What happens when these two things become bound, ownership and belonging? I asked Ben how he thinks this has shaped who we are in the United States.
As we know, property laws are at the very center of how this country was established. One's ability to own property, what it meant to own property, what it didn't mean to own property, what the government could and could not do to your property. All of that is very central.
Who could own property and exactly, who couldn't own property.
Exactly, right? So all of that is central. And so in a real sense, you know, the earliest folks who were trying to build a country here and were using the displacement of indigenous peoples and were using the enslavement of Africans to do so, built a society in which it's really hard for us to think about ownership and belonging as separate. But if we're talking about ownership and land here, we have to talk about what happened to the original peoples of this land. And we also have to talk about the ways in which belonging to this country was so heavily and highly refracted through one's ability to own the bodies of the Africans whose labor was essential to building the country, right? In really deep ways, the ways that we've thought about owning land and people and business have been fundamentally antithetical to the American dream in ways that I think really sort of we're still trying to figure out. Right from the very beginning, we had a beautiful social vision that was just dragged through the crap of all of the practices, the social practices and things that were established, the removal, the murder, the enslavement, the violence, the brutality, all of the unspeakable, the generational, the rape and generational sort of use of ownership as, I mean, I think we often overlook how damning it is that for 2.5 centuries in this country, we practiced owning bodies and their offspring.
Yeah.
As a central economic practice and built a dream on it.
I wonder how we hold this tension. We live in a world where ownership matters. We talk about wealth disparity and income inequality because we know that these things are linked to physical health and life expectancy and quality of life and the future we can provide for our children and our children's children. We know that having a place, a home we own, brings a sense of security, rootedness, and belonging. And we know that this paradigm, that our sense of belonging as bound to what we own, is ultimately toxic and has led to the exploitation of bodies and trees and rivers. It's too often shallow and fleeting. I asked Ben how he holds this tension and what he hopes for his children as they inherit this myth of the American dream.
I'm at a point in my life, Amanda, I think I shared with you, I'm turning 40 soon, which is, you know, it's so a significant old milestone for me. Yeah. But one of the things that's happening as I creep toward 40 is increasingly I can see very clearly that it's important to me, and I think it's healthy that our work means something to us, that we find deep personal meaning in our work. And that our work is not just done for anyone else, even our kids, right? And, you know, I would be lying if I didn't confess, as I share often publicly, that in a really deep sense, so much of what I do is about wanting so desperately for my stepsons, for my baby girl to look back and say, there's a couple things we don't have to deal with because of how daddy and his friends work together. There are a few things that we can point to, a few concrete things that we don't have to deal with, that they talk to us about, that they taught us about, and that we have to work to defend because of how they live. To me, that is such a deep, really immovable part of the best of the Black tradition in America. For people who have so long had so little control over their lives, you talk about ownership, you talk about markets, you talk about community and belonging. For folks who for so long in this country have struggled to experience the best promises of this country in full ways, the best of our tradition has been those profoundly human urges to make sure that my life is spent preparing the way for the folks who are coming behind me. So what does that mean for the American dream? It means that I want my kids to be able to think critically about that dream, to know how much ugliness and trauma and tragedy, their ancestors and the ancestors of other folks have had to come through and heal from and learn from in order for their existence to be possible, one. So I want them to always think critically about that dream. And I also want them to understand that it is their responsibility, when it is their leg of the race, to prepare that dream for the babies who are coming after them. If they're thinking critically about it and they lose themselves in passionate work, that's about the drive that I believe God has put in all of us, or it's different in all of us. But, you know, if they can find that sort of divinely planted drive and they can work in a way where they're committed to making sure that the dream is a little bit more achievable for the folks who are coming after them, I'll go to heaven a happy daddy.
I love it. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, beautiful, Amanda. As always.
Always good to talk to you, friend. Thanks for having me.
You too. Thank you.
Take care.
I learned from Ben that this connection to homeownership, which is so often tied to the myth of the American dream, is about more than financial stability or building wealth. It's about a sense of place and belonging. And the way Black folks have been cut off from this possibility of homeownership is another symptom of a country that was built on telling some people they don't belong. For Black Americans, this has meant that their own bodies were owned and exploited. Even after the end of slavery, systematic efforts were continually made to prevent Black Americans from both gaining financial stability, but also from developing connections, from finding space to create and share stories, to experience the rootedness of community and safety and stability that come from a lasting sense of place. The irony is, I think that this is why homeownership has been a piece of the idea of the American dream. Because home connects us and grounds us and helps us thrive. What does it say about us as a country if some people have been intentionally prevented from experiencing this form of connection and belonging, while others have been encouraged and systematically incentivized to own homes? And what can we do about it? As always, we have resources to learn more about African American experiences of the American dream, about systemic inequality, including all the data, as well as lots more stories. And if you want to take action, we have resources to engage in education through Facing Racism workshops, to contribute to reparations movements, and to give to efforts to support first-time homeowners from Black and Brown communities. The past few weeks have been extremely painful for my friends in Jewish and Palestinian communities after Hamas attacked Israel, murdering more than 1,300 Israeli civilians, taking 200 people hostage. The response by the Israeli military was swift and sweeping, placing Palestinian people who live in Gaza under a hopeless existential threat. My Palestinian friends are reeling and angry and scared. My Jewish friends are reeling and angry and scared. I recorded the next two episodes, first with my friend Rabbi Joe Black, and then second with my Palestinian friend, Colorado legislator Representative Iman Joda, before the violence of the past several weeks. While our interviews do not delve into the current violence, we will be placing this time in the context of those who have fled violence for decades. For Rabbi Joe and Representative Joda, their families each fled violence looking for safety and opportunity in the United States. Don't miss next week's episode with Rabbi Joe Black and the week after that with Representative Iman Joda. Thanks so much for joining us. Sign up for our monthly newsletter to continue the conversation at our website, complexified.org. If anything in this conversation inspired you or sparked your curiosity, please share it with a friend. That is the best way to support us. Complexified is presented by the Institute for Religion, Politics, and Culture at Iliff School of Theology. This episode was created with the support of our student intern, Josh Perez, our sound engineer, Jasmine Hungen, and the team at Podcast Allies. I'm Amanda Henderson.